This is Indie Colorcast, powered by Radio Kismet. I'm Andrew Benioff, the founder of Indie Congress. The conversations you're about to hear were recorded in Miami from February 8th to the 10th of 2022. I think they're important because we heard from industry leaders in independent hospitality on their plans on emerging from the pandemic. My co-host in these conversations is Christopher Plant, the founder of Radio Kismet. Christopher, welcome.
Thank you so much, Andrew.
I found these conversations fascinating as a snapshot in time, as well as being really inspirational. I hope you'll enjoy them as much as I did. Sarah Eustace is the CEO of Main Street Hospitality, a manager and developer of small indie properties.
Here we are live at ILC in Miami. I'm Christopher Plant, and I am sitting today with Sarah Eustace from Main Street Hospitality Group. How are you, Sarah?
I'm very well. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. And so you're here at Miami, at ILC, and you are part of the advisory board. Is that correct?
I am indeed.
And so what does that mean? What do you advise on?
Oh, that's a very good question now that you mention it.
Doesn't necessarily need to be a straightforward answer, but you know.
Well, I think, you know, I got connected to ILC, I think 8 or 9 years ago, which seems
crazy. It's 9 years old, so.
Maybe it was eight. So maybe it was the second year of existence. And I went to the conference at the Highline in New York.
I was there.
And I was just coming back into hospitality where I started my life and that was my family's business. And I just felt like I needed education. And so I was trying everything on and trying to figure out how to learn and who to talk to.
Where do I fit?
Exactly. So I had no clue what I was doing, but I was eager to find out. And so that conference just blew me away.
It was so great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then I continued to stay connected, got to know Andrew better, started to leverage some of those contacts that I had made, you know, from New York, and then joined the advisory board. I actually can't remember when. Maybe it was 2 years later.
We will historically add
in
our new edit of this podcast.
I'm sure somebody has a record, but maybe because it just felt so natural. And the style of collaborative discourse, the sort of diversity of thought and content has just always been really appealing. And I went to I tried on other conferences in the hospitality hotel world, and I found them to be severely lacking.
Finding them cold and inhospitable for a hospitality conference.
And less about sort of my style and the way that I was thinking about things. And you can always get value. It just depends on what you put into it. But
welcome home
so
to ILC.
So here we are. And I love it. And the advisory group is extraordinary in terms of what we do. You know, we make connections for the organization. We build support, whether it's economic or just...
Well, the connections into programming and helping sort of predict the future of hospitality, because I think that, you know, without the opinions and viewpoints of all of you operators, Andrew is less wealthy with the information that he needs to help steer this organization.
Right.
And, you know, one of the things that I personally enjoyed about ILC is in many conferences, there is a high wall between the audience and the stage. And that wall does not exist here at ILC. And,
exactly.
You know, when people walk off the stage, they are immediately surrounded by people. There's conversations going on. And then those same people that have come up to talk to them are on the stage next. And there's a real camaraderie that exists here and an openness from, you know, we saw Neil Shah speak today, who, you know, is the owner operator of a $3 billion Preet. And he was here and he was in it and he was hanging out and chatting and he was having so much fun and we were riding scooters upstairs. And, you know, so, I mean, I think that that's interesting. So, let's dial it back a little bit. And just tell me a little bit about Main Street Hospitality.
Well, we are formally 8 years old. Again, I should know. I'm chronologically challenged today. But we were formed officially in 2014. We started to become an idea probably in 2012 when I came back. I was living in Paris at the time after 20 plus years in apparel retail, working for big brands and learning a lot. Funnily enough, they were all family businesses when I look back on it, whether it was Ralph Lauren or Gap Inc. or Les Wexner at the Limited. So not necessarily by design, but the idea that our family business, which started with one historic hotel 50 years ago, grew to two more that were just more organic and kind of not hobbies, but not core businesses.
Mm-hmm. I will ask you to announce the name and sort of the progeny of your primary hotel, because it's such a well-known sort of commodity, and will provide context to our listeners.
Sure. Our family hotel is the Red Lion Inn in Stockbridge, Massachusetts, where we all grew up working and understanding consciously or unconsciously what hospitality was really about. And the idea that this hotel was the center of the community and it really was an asset for the community, it almost didn't belong to us. We are stewards of it, which is a lot of, it's still the way we think about our hotels. The Red Lion dates from 1773, and it has had one or two lives since then. It did burn and was rebuilt in 1897. It's been added on. We've added different guest houses. It now takes up most of the center of Stockbridge. So, and our family has had it for 50 years.
Are there any famous, well-known people from Stockbridge, Massachusetts that our listeners might be aware of?
Let's see. Well,
aside from Sarah Eustace and
definitely
Co.
not me and Co. There is a guy named Norman Rockwell, who actually almost bought the hotel with my grandfather. And then his wife said that he couldn't invest in such a risky venture. Mm-hmm. So my grandfather decided to go it alone. But Norman Rockwell, James Taylor, Yo-Yo Ma lives down the street. You know, the Berkshires and Stockbridge kind of as the center is just a culturally, profoundly culturally rich environment.
I think it's safe to say it's one of the most unique parts of the United States, and the collection of cultural institutions and the value that they provide to the larger world are amazing. I grew up in the dance world, and so I've, you know, been with performances at Jacob's Pill many times. I've been to Tanglewood. I went to school in Boston, and it was such a draw to come out to Western Mass. And so, yes, I agree.
And one of the things that we also still is an important part of our ethos at Main Street is the relationship between arts and culture and hospitality. So I was just brought up, it was very natural to say, if we support the arts and we support the cultural institutions' demand drivers in our backyard, it will create a virtuous cycle, and it will support our properties and support our business and allow us to pay our people. And it just keeps going around the circle. So we were always encouraged to be involved. I serve on the board of Jacob's Pillow and Tanglewood. We were always encouraged, expected to be involved, to be generous, to be engaged. And now we're taking that juice and doing it in Newport and doing it in Providence and doing it now in Hampton Bays, New York, and doing it in North Adams, because it works, number one, and it builds sustainability for the operation.
I love it. And so what part does the New England sensibility play in your approach to hospitality?
Thriftiness. We don't like spending more on something than we don't have to.
Yeah. Practicality.
Practicality. That's a better way to say it. We love.
Because that doesn't say cheap.
No. And we love design. We love good design. We love beautiful details. We love very high quality experiences. But stuff for stuff's sake, or extras for extras' sake, that's a kind of our Yankee thing, where it's like, why do you need a ribbon around the toilet paper? Like, you're just going to throw it away. That's wasteful.
Yeah.
Right? So we think about things like that, but things that also that create, you know, at the simplest level, objects and art in our hotels are very, are really important, and they're not curated by an art consultant. Like they're collected and done by us because those objects, they don't have to be expensive. Most of them are not, but they have resonance and people attach to them and they come back to look at things. And I think that's kind of it's our design sensibility, which is not expensive. It's kind of more creative, if you will.
And so you have, you know, grown this portfolio considerably during your short tenure as the leader of a long-term sort of legacy-oriented business. And how do you take the sort of tradition that Red Line is sort of built around, and how do you build that into some of your other brands that you're doing in Newport and Providence and now in Long Island?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think the beginning, it didn't feel as strategic, but the birth of Main Street, but it kind of was. I mean, we knew that we wanted to take the material that had been created and cultivated by the first generation of our family. They were very engaged. My grandfather was in politics in Boston, and they were arts patrons, and they had developed, whether it was social capital or reputational capital or just a sort of Red Lion special sauce thing.
That we've been here.
Yeah. And so we tried to bottle that, take that, think about what that really meant, and take it into other communities and work with other partners. And if I had to boil it down, it's hard, but it is about, you know, deep connections and this notion of building connection through very specific ways of interacting with people and investing in the kind of emotional feeling of the experience.
Yeah.
And that we were completely committed to that, and the active and intentional outreach into the community that happened at the Red Lion Inn that makes it a place that is beloved, which makes it a place that even in a pandemic or a downturn or a crisis gives it more roots. Do you know what I mean? Like trees that are older and invested, they don't blow over as fast because those roots are really deep. So even with Hammett's in Newport, for example, you know, $30 million new build on a parking lot that had never had any hospitality on it, we tried to bring this same ethos and connect it and give it roots. And it's only been 2 years and it's already starting to work.
Excellent.
So that was kind of does that answer the question? Sort of.
Well, it gets there. And I think that one of the things that I heard you say, you mentioned strategy, and I like to talk about, you know, strategy to me is intuition frequently applied over and over again.
Yeah.
You like to think on the front side that it was deliberate and super purposeful, but generally it's just your own good wits being applied to a principle or a problem. And you do that over and over again. And then on the backside, you get to say, oh, well, that was my strategy all along. And so, I mean, I think that what I really enjoy, and, you know, I think I told you a little bit about my own personal experience, wanting to reconnect with Western Mass, and kismetically, the Red Lion appeared before me, and I won a raffle, and I came to see it, and just ate it up. Was like in there. I love history. I love the sort of old school charm of the place, but the service was excellent. Everybody was on point. You know, the food and hospitality was classic, yet it was delivered with the same level of care that I would want from let me say this. I went to other 4-star restaurants in that area that did not outperform Red Lion. So
that's great to hear.
Yeah.
I'm so glad.
Yeah. And I sat at your bar, and I think that one of the things that's interesting about the historical dimension of what you have there is that it invites a camaraderie within the guests that allows for more, you know, sort of pedestrian connection than you might have in, say, like a super luxury where you are defined by your bracelet, your ring, your bag. And I mean, I had so many conversations there, and I think I told you a little bit about that. But I mean, I think that, you know, I'm intrigued learning more about your brand and even, like I said, about your journey. And so that's actually, I'll steer this that way. So you came from a hotel background, and you went out into the world, and you were working in fashion. You were living in Europe, and what was the real impetus for you to come back and help the family in the next stages of running your hospitality group?
Well, it was at the risk of sounding sort of there was an actual epiphany that did occur.
I like an epiphany.
Love a good epiphany, and I remember driving from New York City to the Berkshires, which we did every weekend.
I would imagine that that is a familiar route for you.
Yeah, and we were, and I remember turning, I literally remember kind of coming around a corner, and I was, I don't know, maybe I was 40 at the time, and I kind of said, I think by the time I'm 50.
That's last year, folks.
Yeah, huh? I think by the time I'm 50, I'll probably be up here doing something with our family business. It just like appeared to me. And then the other epiphany was when my grandfather died and we were living in France and we came back. It was 2010 and sitting, he was a very well attended memorial service. And I looked around and my family was around me and my brothers are great guys. They're off doing other things. And the second generation was really getting ready to do other things. And I kind of looked around and not only, not a sense of obligation, but more like, wow, we've created a lot of good material here and a lot of good goodness. And there don't seem to be any people stepping up to steward it into the next generation. And so it was kind of sitting there that it hit me that it probably was what I should be doing.
Yeah.
And we were at the time trying to figure out whether to stay living in Paris or move back to New York and sort of crawl up the ladder again.
Mm-hmm.
And it just became less and less appealing. And so we made the leap and in 2012 moved back to the Berkshires with our two young boys and just started to put one foot in front of the other and figure out whether there was enough there that was going to actually sustain everybody.
Yeah.
And it turns out there was.
Yeah. And so what was the scariest thing about coming back? I mean, was it like potentially like being bored? I mean, you were in Paris. You had lived in the sort of metropolitan capitals of the world. The quote from, Michael Corleone sort of comes to me where like, I was out and you pulled me back in, you know, like where, you know, I know a lot of people like run away from family businesses only to find later on that the core values that they got from those businesses as kids and as young adults, you throw them away so you can go be your unique independent self. And then suddenly, you know, later, you know, you may be 40 driving up the Berkshires and you're like, wait a minute, I think I'm probably going to come back to this. And, you know, you kind of not that you effectively sowed your wild oats, but you went out, you saw the world, you evaluated and you liked where you came from.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. But, and then weirdly, you know, as I mentioned, all those big corporations were family businesses. And the thing that I remember that I thought also was worth doing, and I kind of said, wow, if I've got X years of, you know, professional energy left in my career, why not put it in our family business as opposed to Ralph Lauren's? God bless Ralph. Love him. But what was great is that those owners who then had mega public companies that they had built showed up every day. And mm-hmm. and they struggled with succession planning and everybody does, but they really did show up and they talked about why the company existed, what were the values, why it was important. And I had the privilege of working very closely with those founders in mm-hmm. my roles at those companies. And I try to do that. I think that's very meaningful to a workforce and a community of people who are working in a company to have the family and the founder be very present and engaged. So I don't know if we're answering your question.
No, you are. I mean, I just wanted to know kind of like what you were.
The scariest thing.
Yeah.
Okay,
you got it.
Well, it was not. Not about being bored, but it was more like there was definitely an economic lifestyle change that we had to see if it was going to be sustainable. The family dynamics and whether that was really going to work. We worked really hard at not becoming a statistic in terms of third generation businesses petering out.
Mm-hmm.
So we've invested a lot in family business planning.
But
that was scary. It was scary. My husband, you know, had to move back into the warm embrace of my family and they all love him. But it was just, it was, the outcome was uncertain, but we knew that it was worth a try.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
No, I get it. I mean, it sounds exciting. And I have, I don't know how familiar you are with the Philadelphia market, but DeBruner Brothers. Do you know that brand?
I don't.
It's a third generation Italian eatery, salumery, cheesery.
Oh, yes.
And they are essentially the Dean and DeLuca of Philadelphia. And they're in their third generation. And so I've talked to them a lot and worked on projects. And the percentage of businesses that, you know, make it through to a third generation is less than 7%. And the realities there are that the sort of bastardization of what the original intent or practice of that brand was is very, very frequent. And so I can see how, especially with brothers and families and multi-generations, and I've spent a lot of time in England, in New England, and I know that it is a land of highly opinionated people who like to share their opinions. And so I'm sure that regardless of all of your incredible professional experience and working with these major brands and having access to, you know, world-class players on international level, that you still came home and you're probably like, oh, if my brother says some shit to me,
oh yeah,
I'm gonna smack his ass.
Oh, you have no idea.
I think I do.
It was sort of, and we go from the sublime to the ridiculous pretty much every day, but that's what's great about what we're doing. So we'll be on, you know, we'll be here at ILC, and then tomorrow we'll be back, and we'll all be fluffing pillows in the lobby, and we'll be dealing with some, you know, a busted pipe at our new property in North Adams. But that's, I think, and I never, you know, we are absolutely growing. We have an intentional desire to build the company, but not in a way that removes us. I've worked in huge companies, and I just, it's that tension of growth and not getting too removed from what it is we're actually doing and who we're actually serving. And it can happen very easily.
Yeah.
And so we're committed to doing that while still trying to scale in a way that's reasonable.
Yeah. I'm going to ask you one more question.
Okay.
And that is, ILC to me is, you know, like, and I've heard community, I've heard progress, I've heard little things. If you could just give me one little kind of zinger soundbite on that.
ILC is, and I'm going to steal somebody else's word, but I just heard it in the elevator. It's kind of like my hospitality nutrition.
There you go.
It gives me vitamins.
I love it. Thank you for listening to these conversations.
Make sure to check out our upcoming events at ilcongress.com under events.